Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So, picture yourself walking along a beach.
Okay, I'm there.
You look down, and you see a discarded crab shell, or maybe, like, the remnants of a shrimp washed up by the tide. It looks like just another piece of lifeless ocean debris.
Right, just typical stuff you'd step over.
Exactly. But if you were to zoom in, way, way down to the microscopic level, a completely different story is unfolding. Because what really happens when microscopic life settles on the discarded shells of sea creatures?
It's actually wild because it turns out the ocean water around that shell is swirling with invisible free-floating genetic code.
Yeah, and we need to understand how certain microbes might be capturing it. So today we're exploring a fascinating mystery. What really happens when a notorious human pathogen uses ocean debris as like an underwater genetic library?
And, you know, how could this change our understanding of how bacteria evolve new dangerous traits?
Right. Our mission in this deep dive is to figure out the mechanics behind this invisible exchange and what it means for the oceans you swim in.
It is a remarkable question. I mean, the answer fundamentally changes how we view the aquatic environment. We are looking at a scenario where discarded biological material isn't just waste, it's actually an active, dynamic hub for evolution.
Today, we celebrate the work of Jacob D. Holt, Yixuan Peng, Triana N. Dahlia, Encore B. Dahlia, Carrie D. Nadell, alongside Dartmouth College, the Geisel School of Medicine, and Indiana University, who have advanced our understanding of horizontal gene transfer in aquatic environments.
Yes, and I should note, this open access research was published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, on May 30, 2025.
So let's set the stage here. The specific organism they focused on to unravel this mystery is Vibrio cholerae.
Right. And when you hear that name, you likely think of the severe human diarrheal disease, cholera. Historically, we associate it with contaminated drinking water.
Yeah, you probably picture, like, Jon Snow in Victorian London tracking an outbreak to a single water pump.
Exactly. But looking at it purely as a human pathogen totally misses the broader biological reality. Vibrio cholerae is, at its core, a marine microbe. Its evolutionary home has always been the ocean, estuaries, and coastal waters, long before it ever encountered a human host.
Right, and to survive out there in the massive ocean, it doesn't just float around aimlessly, it forms biofilms.
Which are crucial for its survival.
Yeah. For those of you listening, imagine a biofilm as a dense, sticky community of bacteria all huddled together sharing resources and protection. And Vibrio cholerae loves to build these biofilms on cheatin.
Which is everywhere in the ocean.
Right. Cheatin is the tough, structural biopolymer that makes up the shells of crabs, shrimp, and other crustaceans. It is literally the most abundant biomaterial in the ocean.
It is.
So for this bacteria, a discarded shell is essentially a giant floating buffet. They attach to it and consume it as a source of carbon and nitrogen.
But here's where the paradox emerges. When we look at what else happens during that process, it gets weird. When V. cholerae attaches to chitin to consume it, it upregulates a specific set of genes to activate a process known as natural competence.
Okay, I want to make sure we are totally clear on that term, because natural competence sounds like a polite performance review at work.
That's true. It does sound a bit bureaucratic.
What we're really talking about is horizontal gene transfer, right?
Yeah.
The ability of a bacteria to suddenly start absorbing extracellular DNA right out of its environment.
That is the core mechanism, yes. Most organisms, humans included, inherit their genetic information vertically, you know, from parent to offspring.
Right.
But horizontal gene transfer allows bacteria to acquire DNA from completely unrelated organisms in their immediate surroundings. They pull loose genetic material inside their cell wall and splice it into their own genome.
Like a rapid shortcut to acquiring new traits.
Exactly. If a nearby bacteria dies and bursts open, releasing a gene for antibiotic resistance, a competent V. cholerae cell can absorb that gene and immediately become resistant itself.
But wait, I have to push back on the logic here. Because if you sit down to eat a sandwich, you don't suddenly start looking for instruction manuals to read.
No, you definitely don't.
Why does eating a shell trigger a bacteria to take up DNA? It seems like two completely unrelated activities. I mean, you're there for lunch, not a library visit.
The field has wrestled with that exact sandwich and instruction manual problem for years. Like, why would a structural carbohydrate trigger a massive energetic shift toward genetic scavenging?
It just doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, the researchers proposed a brilliant hypothesis centered on the physical chemistry of the ocean. Chitin is an insoluble biopolymer, and under certain marine conditions, its surface can become positively charged.
Okay, and DNA is negatively charged.
All right.
Exactly. Due to its phosphate backbone, it's highly negatively charged. Opposites attract. The researchers suspected that maybe chitin itself acts as a sticky electrostatic trap for ocean DNA.
Oh, wow.
So the bacteria might not just be going to the shell for food, they might be going there because the chitin has gathered a wealth of genetic information from the surrounding water.
A sticky genetic trap.
Yeah.
But, you know, to test a hypothesis like that, you can't just throw a crab shell in a bucket of water and look at it.
No, definitely not.
You have to essentially recreate the ocean floor in a laboratory setting, but in a way that lets you monitor individual microscopic interactions.
Mm.
How do they actually do that?
They accomplish this using a microfluidic device. To visualize this, picture a transparent chip, roughly the size of a postage stamp, with incredibly tiny channels carved into it.
Like channels so small you need a microscope to see what is flowing through them.
Exactly. Inside these microscopic chambers, they constructed physical barriers out of tiny pillar obstacles. Then they loaded sterilized chitin flakes into these chambers.
So the pillars acted like a cage.
Yeah, they trapped the chitin flakes in place so they wouldn't wash away when liquids were introduced.
And then they turned on the artificial ocean. They started pumping artificial seawater over these trapped chitin flakes continuously for 16 hours.
Right, but they spiked the seawater with something crucial. Free-floating DNA that had been tagged with a fluorescent dye called CCI3.
So if you were to shine a specific laser on it, this DNA would glow a bright red color.
Exactly. And they kept the flow rate extremely slow and steady, about 15 micrometers per second.
Why so slow?
Well, the flow rate is important because they needed to mimic gentle laminar ocean currents, not chaotic turbulence. But equally important was the concentration of that fluorescent DNA. They introduced the DNA at a concentration of 0.13 micrograms per liter of artificial seawater.
Let me stop you there, because 0.13 micrograms per liter sounds, well, almost vanishingly small.
It is very small.
For you listening, think of a large water bottle and dropping in a fraction of a speck of dust.
Is that a realistic amount of DNA to just be floating around in the ocean? Are we setting up a hyper-concentrated artificial scenario here?
It's actually the exact opposite. That concentration is highly conservative. If we go out and sample actual seawater, the amount of environmental DNA, or EDA, is significantly higher.
Really?
Yeah. The ocean is essentially a vast soup of biological material. Every time an algae cell dies, a virus bursts a bacteria, or a fish sheds scales, DNA is released into the water column.
So it's just everywhere.
Exactly. In shallow coastal waters, empirical measurements show DNA concentrations ranging from 1.5 to 2.0 micrograms per liter.
Yeah.
Even in deep, open ocean waters, it hovers between 0.1 and 0.3.
Okay, so by using 0.13, the researchers ensured that if they observed DNA sticking to the chitin, it wasn't just an artifact of flooding the system with unnatural amounts of genetic material.
Precisely.
That reframes how I think about swimming in the ocean, honestly. You're swimming through a genetic soup.
You really are. So after running this DNA-spiked water over the chitin for 16 hours, they face a massive mechanical problem. How do they know they're looking at DNA that actually stuck to the shell? And not just DNA that happens to be floating past the camera lens at that exact second.
That's a great point. To isolate only the bound DNA, they instituted a rigorous 24-hour wash step.
Oh, wow, an entire day.
Yeah, they completely stopped the flow of the DNA-laced water and switched the pumps to pure, sterile, artificial seawater. For 24 hours, they flushed the chambers to clear out any unbound, loose DNA.
And they measured the water coming out the other side to prove it was clean, right?
They did. They used an instrument called a Quibit fluorometer, which is hypersensitive to genetic material. They found that after the 24-hour wash, the amount of DNA in the effluent water dropped completely to the limit of detection.
So it was zero. Indistinguishable from a control chamber that never had any DNA added in the first place.
Exactly. Which leads us to the first major observation. When they placed those washed chitin flakes under a powerful confocal microscope, which uses lasers to reconstruct high-resolution three-dimensional images, the results were striking.
What did they see?
The water-facing surfaces of the chitin were heavily coated in that red fluorescent DNA. The flow of the water had plastered the DNA against the structural obstacles, and the chitin had held onto it despite a 24-hour power wash.
I'm picturing, like, glowing red moss growing on the side of a rock in a river. The water flows over it, but the moss just stays locked on.
The imagery is apt. They have proven the first part of their hypothesis. Chitin does indeed act as a sponge, pulling environmental DNA out of the flowing water and concentrating it on its surface.
But demonstrating that chitin collects DNA is only half the battle, right?
Right. The far more complex biological question is whether a microbe can actually utilize this surface-bound DNA. I mean, just because a book is glued to a library shelf doesn't mean you have the ability to pry it off and read it.
Yeah, if it's stuck tight enough to survive a 24-hour wash, maybe it's stuck too tight for the bacteria to use. So to test this, they introduced Vibrio cholerae into the chambers.
But not just any Vibrio. The researchers engineered a specific reporter strain.
Walk us through how they built this diagnostic tool.
They utilized a technique called homologous recombination to create a very specific genetic mutation. They took the gene that produces green fluorescent protein, or GFT, and intentionally broke it.
So it wouldn't glow.
Right. They inserted a premature stop codon into the genetic sequence. So if you were to look at this engineered V. cholerae strain under a microscope, it would not glow green. It has the machinery, but the blueprint is missing a critical piece.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm translating this correctly for our listeners. It's almost like putting a dye pack in a bank bag.
That's a good way to look at it.
It just sits there doing nothing. But it's designed to visually signal when a very specific triggering event has happened.
A perfect analogy. The trigger, in this case, relies on the DNA they had previously washed over the chitin. That red fluorescent DNA stuck to the shell wasn't just random code.
Oh, let me guess. It contained the exact corrected sequence needed to repair the broken GFP gene inside the bacteria.
Exactly. It's a living diagnostic test. If the bacteria attach to the chitin, activate their natural competence, and successfully pry that specific piece of DNA off the surface, they can integrate it into their own genome.
And if they do that successfully, the broken gene is repaired. The cell will start manufacturing the functional protein, and it will suddenly light up bright green under the microscope.
You've got it. So they inoculated the microfluidic chambers with this broken GFP strain, maintained the flow of sterile seawater, and waited. After 48 hours, they used high-resolution live cell microscopy to survey the chitin surfaces.
And the results, did they light up?
They did. Green glowing bacteria appeared directly on the chitin surfaces. The transformants, the individual cells that had successfully taken up the DNA and repaired their genome, were sitting right there, anchored to the shell.
That is incredible. The bacteria were entirely capable of harvesting DNA that was tightly bound to a solid surface.
Yes. And just to head off any skeptics who might say, well, that only works on perfectly pure laboratory-grade chitin flakes, the researchers took it a step further.
What did they do?
They went out, caught wild shrimp, took raw, unfrozen pieces of their actual shells, and repeated the entire experiment.
And it still worked.
The results replicated flawlessly. The bacteria could pull the DNA off the raw, wild shrimp shell just as effectively as the purified lab chitin.
That robustly proves that out there in the real world, biological sea debris acts as a genetic distribution center.
It does. But this observation leads to a profound biomechanical puzzle. If the DNA is bound to the chitin so strongly that 24 hours of continuous fluid flow couldn't dislodge it, how does a microscopic single-celled organism generate the physical force necessary to rip it off?
Right. Let's break down the mechanics of natural competence. When a bacteria like Vibrio cholerae wants to grab DNA, it doesn't just open a mouth. It uses these dynamic microscopic appendages called type 4 pili.
Right, Pelis.
For those of you listening, you can think of a type 5e pilus as a microscopic grappling hook. The bacteria expends a huge amount of energy to assemble this long, thin fiber, shoots it out through its membrane into the environment, binds the tip of the fiber to a piece of DNA, and then violently retracts the fiber, reeling the DNA inside the cell wall.
And that retraction process is the key. Pulling that fiber back in requires mechanical force, which is generated by specific motor proteins at the base of the pilus.
Okay.
The researchers zeroed in on one specific motor protein called PU. PU is a force-generating retraction motor. Now, the scientific community already knew PU existed.
But what was the mystery?
Well, previous experiments tested bacteria in liquid cultures, essentially just floating in a test tube surrounded by free-floating DNA. Under those easy liquid conditions, a mutant strain of V. cholerae that was completely missing the PiLU motor could still take up DNA perfectly fine.
So it seemed like PU was just like an accessory, not a necessity.
Exactly.
I see where this is going. It's the difference between towing a boat through open water versus trying to pull a sunken boat out of thick, sticky mud.
That is exactly it.
For the open water, like your free-floating liquid DNA, a small, basic motor is totally fine. It doesn't take much torque. But to pull that boat out of the mud, to rip that DNA off the tightly bound chitin surface, you need a heavy-duty winch.
And let's look at the mechanics of what they built to test your winch analogy. They took the mutant strain, the one genetically stripped of the PyOU motor, and put it into their chitin microfluidic device. They provided the chitin, the bound DNA, and the ocean flow.
So without the PyOU motor, the grappling hook attaches to the DNA, but it just doesn't have the strength to pull it off the shell, does it?
The mutant's ability to take up the chitin-bound DNA was nearly eliminated.
Wow.
Yeah, the baseline competence machinery was intact, but without the high-torque PyOU motor, they simply couldn't overcome the physical bond between the DNA and the chitin surface.
That is a staggering realization. It shows that Vibrio cholerae hasn't just randomly stumbled into the ability to take up DNA.
No, it's highly specialized.
Over millions of years, it has specifically evolved the high-powered biomechanical machinery required to harvest DNA from challenging sticky surfaces. It built a specialized winch because it knows that's where the most valuable cargo is located.
If we step back and connect the dots across evolutionary timescales, it completely resolves the paradox we discussed earlier.
The sandwich in the instruction manual.
Exactly. Why turn on genetic competence when you're just eating a shell? The answer is that Vibrio cholerae has learned that chitin isn't just a sandwich. It is an expansive, curated library.
Because as ocean currents carry these microscopic chitin particles across the globe, they're constantly collecting DNA from countless dying organisms. Algae, other bacteria, viruses, decomposing fish.
Right.
The shell essentially becomes a dense, localized repository of environmental genetic information.
And when V. cholerae lands on a piece of chitin, it upregulates its competence machinery because it recognizes it has landed on a genetic goldmine. The bacteria is exploiting a physical property of the ocean environment.
It doesn't even need to hunt for live bacteria to interact with.
No. The shell has been drifting for miles, passively soaking up DNA the whole time. The bacteria can simply anchor itself, begin digesting the shell for carbon, and simultaneously sample the accumulated library to see if there is any useful code it can splice into its own genome.
To gain a survival advantage, it's an incredibly opportunistic, highly efficient evolutionary strategy. But I want to make sure we ground this in reality.
Of course.
The microfluidic chip is an elegant model, but the real ocean is a massive, chaotic, turbulent environment. There must be limitations to how easily this translates to a global scale.
There are significant barriers, absolutely. The researchers have beautifully demonstrated that Vibrio cholerae can utilize this surface-bound reservoir in a controlled environment using specific homologous DNA sequences.
Meaning DNA that is very similar to its own.
Right. Future research must explore the frequency of complex cross-species gene transfer in the wild. How often does a piece of DNA from a completely different marine organism successfully integrate into the Vibrio gene and actually function?
Because the cell has defense mechanisms against foreign DNA, so it's not a guaranteed success every time the grappling hook pulls something in.
Exactly. You can't just plug random lines of code into a computer program and expect it to run perfectly.
Right. But the fact that the mechanism exists and is so highly optimized with that heavy-duty PyOU motor strongly suggests it happens often enough to provide a massive evolutionary advantage. I mean, if it didn't work, the bacteria wouldn't waste the massive amounts of energy required to build the winch.
It radically reframes our understanding of marine debris. These chitin surfaces are not inert waste. They are environmental hotspots for horizontal gene transfer. They are physical accelerators for bacterial evolution, providing both the fuel in the form of food and the blueprints for adaptation.
Okay, let's bring it all together. Chitin surfaces in the ocean naturally accumulate free-floating environmental DNA, creating a reservoir of genetic material. Microbes like V. cholerae have evolved specialized retraction motors to forcefully harvest this bound DNA, allowing them to acquire new genetic traits simply by colonizing marine debris.
And when we consider that Vibrio cholerae is a pathogen capable of causing global pandemics, the mechanisms by which it acquires new, potentially dangerous genetic traits in its natural environment carry profound implications for human health.
Which leaves us with a critical question for you to think about long after this deep dive ends. We know that ocean currents transport discarded shells and debris across vast distances, intimately connecting entirely different marine ecosystems. What does this mean for the spread of pathogenic traits across global ocean currents?
The ocean isn't just moving water, it is physically connecting genetic libraries on a planetary scale.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoy this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Till it weighs like sun on a shell bone lattice, pale and tight. Stories drifting, then locked to the white. Not gone, not lost, just held in place. Pinned to the surface, waiting for a face. A quiet archive in the moving blue. And every touch says, this can change you. Pull it back, pull it through the grain. From the chitin skin to the living strain. A borrowed line, a brand new start. Hot spots under tide where genome swap hearts. Hold on, hold tight. Let the current prove what sticks can spread when the pile is most. Recoil, high force retraction for the stubborn spoil. If the bull goes missing, the change runs thin, but the anchored code still hums. Begin. Pull it back, pull it through the grain, from the chitin skin.